I don't know if it was last class or two classes ago, I told you about I think I told you about the fact that the historical measurements of input parameters to the historical measurements of input parameters to the standard model and how they changed over time, or they so here's a printout of these things, which you can have a look at. Just pass it around and see what I was referring to. You know I'm not making this stuff up. Okay, and then now let's continue with this Poisson bracket formulation of classical and quantum mechanics. So last class we defined what the Poisson bracket was, and we said basically we assume we have an algebra with elements Q, alpha J, Q alpha I, P beta J. So this is a set. And then of course they satisfy, under the Poisson bracket, they satisfy so here, alpha and beta are elements of x, y, z, and I, j are elements of 1 to n. So we have n particles. Each particle lives in three-dimensional space. And then we have the Poisson bracket relationship, which is one of our defining properties of the Poisson bracket. Are these Dirac delta function conditions. So basically, things commute under the Poisson bracket unless they're on the same particle in the same physical direction in space, in the same coordinate for this. And then we had a fundamental or I should say a postulate, let's just call it a postulate. Postulate for dynamics, and this is just kind of unmotivated. There might be some clever way to motivate it, but I don't know what it is, which is you assume that some function f, which is some polynomial in these elements of the algebra, is going to evolve according to some Hamiltonian function via the Poisson bracket. Okay, so this is a Poisson bracket, which I've drawn in a really sloppy way. Let me redo it. For H, H is the energy function. And F also is some function of Q and P. Of the Qs and Ps. Okay, so this is our setup. We have a Poisson bracket, which satisfies certain axiomatic properties, and we have these primitive coordinates, and we have a dynamical law. And now the idea is that we can get both classical and quantum mechanics from this. Idea, classical mechanics follows from assuming a commutative algebra and quantum mechanics follows from assuming a non-commutative algebra. So basically, as I mentioned last class, if the Q's and P's commute, then there exists a representation of the Poisson bracket in terms of differential equations, in terms of partial differentials, partial derivatives. And in particular, that representation is the following. Given F and G, we have a sum over I, J, sum over alpha, beta, just alpha and just I. So here alpha is an element of x, y, z. And we have del f by del q I alpha, del g by del p I alpha, minus del f by del p I alpha, del g by del q I alpha. And now what we're going to do is we're going to let G equal H, the Hamiltonian function. And then we get df by dt is equal to sum over I. In the notes, you don't have these notes. In these notes, I just do it for one dimension, but let me just do it in general. So just basically, this is just a straight substitution here. Okay, so that's by substituting. But now we can also use the chain rule. Also, we can apply the chain rule . Remember f is a function of q, p, and t, where t is some parameter in this picture. And if we apply the chain rule, then we get df by dt is equal to sum over I, sum over alpha, del f by del q I alpha, dq by dt. Where does this minus sign come from? Oh, that's perfect. It's right there. Del f by del p I alpha, del p I alpha by dt, plus the explicit time dependence of f. But now we can compare sides. anything with minus sign? Oh, this is plus here. Yes, thank you. Okay, then comparing these two equations, we recover Hamilton's equations of motion. Okay, which are the assumption is that Q and P, the partials become full derivatives because Q and P are functions of nothing else. They're independent variables. Yeah. Go backwards, you mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's one way, but see, the point is, I mean, yes, that is something you can do. There are consistency conditions here. But what I'm interested in is some kind of abstract formulation of dynamics itself, which leads to classical mechanics and quantum mechanics as consequences. Yeah, the point is, I mean, you know, I mean, I'm telling you guys this because, you know, you're studying general relativity, you're going to go on to, you know, look into building the next generation of theories, to solving this problem of quantum gravity. So I think it's important that you understand different insights that exist out there about how we can abstract out some very broad mathematical principles or just principles that are deeper than either classical mechanics or quantum mechanics independently. And so that's what this is a sketch of. I mean, I don't know if this is going to be a useful path, but I think it's very compelling. And by the way, I should mention this. I think I mentioned it at a previous class, but this insight is like 60 years old, and it's from Dirac. But it's not very well known. Most people don't know it. So anyway, so we've gotten Hamilton's equations of motion, but I think that there's something even more interesting that you get from classical mechanics, which is, but instead of Hamilton's equations, we can get Liouville's equation. So how many of you know what Liouville's equation is? I think I've mentioned it in passing. Okay, not many of you remember, or maybe I didn't mention it, I don't recall. So Liouville's equation, which is 120 years old, is a partial differential equation describing how essentially incomplete knowledge of a classical system evolves in time. Okay, so Liouville said, look, we have Hamilton's equations of motion. It tells us that if we know precisely the position and the momentum of some cannonball, we can predict where it's going to land based on the known forces and the initial conditions. And he said, but in practice, we never have perfect knowledge. I mean, classical mechanics tells us that in principle, we can have as precise knowledge as we want about the independent variables. But in practice, you never have perfect knowledge. So he was interested in the problem of, well, how can I describe, when I have some uncertainty about the system's coordinates, how can I describe how that uncertainty evolves in time? So the idea is I assign a probability density in phase space corresponding to your knowledge. So this is Q and this is P. This is obviously a one-dimensional system. And then you would have some, and this is rho of Q, P at some time T naught. So here, just think of this as like a contour map. So the idea is that there are heights, the probability density has some height that comes out of the board. That's the weighting associated with each of these points. This is supposed to be closed curves. Okay, so like this would be like from a like a geography idea, this would be like a mountain, right? So this is a probability density, and so it integrates to one. For any t. And of course it's non-negative. So now what we can do is we can say, well, this is our fundamental dynamical law. So let's let the function f be our probability density. So let f equal rho. Then you get d rho by dt is equal to rho comma h plus del rho by del t. Now there's a property of classical mechanics, which is the fact that the evolution is symplectic, which is area preserving. So I'm not going to go into the details of it, but this is, for example, in Goldstein's classic textbook on classical mechanics. Conservation of areas under Hamiltonian flow implies that d rho by dt is equal to zero. So the idea is this. My system, this point in phase space is going to evolve under time to some point here. This point is going to evolve in time to some point here. Some point in the interior is going to evolve in time to some point here. And you're going to have, this is rho QPT at some time T1. But the fact that each point in this phase space is evolving under Hamiltonian evolution implies that the area contained by the probability density is conserved. And that implies that this full derivative of rho is zero. And then we get the Liouville equation directly as del rho by del t is equal to h rho. Now, I didn't even introduce the von Neumann equation, which is embarrassing. So I should have told you at some point, once you learn about density operators, so you know how quantum state vectors evolve in time, it's the Schrodinger equation. So compare with the von Neumann equation, which is basically Schrodinger evolution for the density operator. And that is I'm going to get this right up to a minus sign. I would ask I would ask one of you to let me know if I got the minus sign right. Well, you guys aren't answering my question. Just tell me if there should be a minus sign right here or not. It's going to flip the order of the bracket, right? There are many ways to do it. I want this way. I have one particular way. Anyways, you guys can figure that out. You're bright students.
That is correct.
Awesome. Okay, good. So, I mean, notice the differences. So here, basically, this is a Poisson bracket. And this is a commutator. But it turns out this is also a Poisson bracket, and I'll show you that right now. There's also a subtle difference between the full and the partial derivative. Finally figured out how to work this blackboard and the lectures are over. It's too bad, eh? So now Dirac observed that, so let me say quantum mechanics here. Okay, so what's our starting point? So we started out, we defined the Poisson bracket last class. I'm reminding you of this. We demand that there be some primitive independent variables which satisfy this particular Poisson bracket relationship, and we postulate a dynamical law, and then we said, okay, now let's assume that we have a commutative algebra, and we got Hamilton's equations, and we got Liouville's equation, which pretty much defines classical mechanics from these simple assumptions. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to return to that starting point, but now we're going to allow the algebra to be non-commutative. If we allow the algebra to be non-commutative, then there is a unique, up to a constant, there's a unique representation of the Poisson bracket. So it turns out when I told you that expression in terms of partial derivatives, I told you that was a representation of the Poisson bracket for the commutative case. So for the commutative case, the representation is actually not unique. But in the non-commutative case, the representation is unique. So I'll say unique because it's unique up to a scalar. So we can now quickly derive this. So consider the basic rules of the Poisson bracket, and we have some function f1 times some function f2, Poisson bracket with some function g1 and g2. So f1, f2, g1, and g2, you can think of these as, say, some simple functions of the q's and p's, but we're dealing with the non-commutative case. So what we're going to do is we're going to add a hat just to remind us that these are non-commutative objects. These are non-commutative. So let's consider an expression of this form. Now we can use the defining properties of the Poisson bracket to evaluate this. In particular, we can use Leibniz's law, and we can write this as f1, f2, g1, g2, plus f1, g1, g2, f2. And then we can pull the g out. Notice that if you remember the rules of the commutator, it's essentially the same thing, but here you don't know that yet. We're discovering that. So we're just using the Poisson bracket rules. This is kind of tedious to write all this out. Okay, so now we've reduced this composite expression in terms of just the Poisson bracket of the individual functions. But now it turns out that we could have, here we took f out first. We dealt with the first term, the first argument of the Poisson bracket first, and then we used Leibniz's law on the second argument. But we could have done it the other way. We could have applied Leibniz's law to simplify the second term first. Or equivalently, we have f1, f2, g1, g2 is equal to g1. F1, F2, G2 plus F1, F2, G1, G1, G2. Okay, and I'll just write it all out. And now we just continue and we get G1, F1, F2, G2. Sorry, my G's look like Q's, plus G1, F1, G2, F2, plus F1, F2, G1, G2, plus F1, G1, F2, G2. But so now the left-hand sides are equal, so the right-hand sides have to be equal. And that, it turns out, what we're going to do is we're going to... why do the cross terms cancel? Here? Oh, right. This should be, it's a typo in my notes. So this should be G1 here. Okay. Why is that the case? All right, so now if we equate these two expressions, the cross terms are going to cancel. And now I didn't remind myself why that's the case. It must be because we can, why is that? Oh, right, exactly. Okay, perfect. Okay, so then equating these expressions, we basically get, I'm just going to skip one step and you can, so I'm skipping one step here. Now this has to hold, this must hold for every F1, G1, F2, and G2, which means that we can deduce that the Poisson bracket of F1, G1 is proportional to the product F1, G1 minus G1, F1. Which is exactly the commutator. So if we're going to have some algebraic elements that are non-commutative and satisfy our Poisson bracket, our form of Poisson algebra with this Poisson bracket relationship, it must be the case that the Poisson bracket is proportional to the commutator. So now we define the commutator in this way. And we take the proportionality because of empirical evidence. We get quantum mechanics by choosing the proportionality to be IH bar. Well, I shouldn't have written on that backboard first. Okay, so then we choose our undefined scalar, our undetermined scalar, to be IH bar, and we get that the Poisson bracket of some functions f and g is equal to 1 over IH bar times the commutator of f and g. Okay, then we return to our dynamical law, which we postulated. And we get then df by dt is equal to f h over ih bar plus df by dt, which is Heisenberg's equation of motion. If we choose f to be, there's some subtlety here. If we choose f to be the density operator, then it must be that one of these is zero. I don't remember this piece. Yeah, there's some subtlety here about how to get von Neumann's equation from this, which I have to think about because I can't remember exactly how it works. Tom?
What if you make your constant real rather measure, then is your mechanics start to be like confusion?
Well, you would certainly get diffusion. Well, sorry. No, it's not right. So diffusion is a classical process as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But the problem is that here we're assuming Hamilton's equations of motion. So we won't get diffusion because it'll be area conserving. It's only if you add.
Right.
It's only if you, probably what you have to do is you have to have a classical phase space that has many degrees of freedom. And then the way to get diffusion is you trace out some of those degrees of freedom, and that would give us diffusion classically. Whether in this quantum setting with non-commutative operators you get diffusion, I don't know. I don't know what would happen.
So I mean, the one thing for me is like if I make that constant real, then everything that looks like the body looks like the IHD or something that can become the IHD. And then you have like it would be exponential increase or exponential.
Yeah, it's not going to be quantum mechanics anyways. Yeah, so the two pieces in here that are kind of mysterious is, you know, where does this dynamical law come from? Why would it have that form? Is there some way we can justify that rather than pull it out of a hat? And, you know, maybe this is asking too much, but is there some way to, other than just appealing to what works, justifying why we choose the proportionality constant to be IH bar? I think those are two pieces which potentially could have an explanation that's as yet unknown. Did you have a question or withdrawn? I'm sorry? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Getting the von Neumann equation out. Yeah. Because, I mean, okay, so, I mean, you know, for me, partials and full derivatives are always kind of slippery business, and I have to think about it really carefully. So here, we're allowing f to be a function of qp and t, and then we're taking rho just to be, we have Heisenberg's equations of motion, so already that's great, right? I mean, in some sense, once you have Heisenberg's equations of motion, you have everything. Maybe that might work. I don't know if the minus sign would turn out right. The board is hidden, so we'll have to check that. Oh, yeah? Okay, good. Well, maybe that's all we need then. But it's hard to see. I mean, I know that's going to work, but it's hard to see exactly how that's justified. The total time derivative to be conserved. Well, that's what happens in the... Well, what's confusing for me is that if you think about the density operator, I mean, it's not really a function of Q and P. So what's confusing is that it really only has one parameter. It's a function just of time. So normally df by dt and del f by dt would be the same. So it's almost like these two things cancel each other. So there's something fishy there still that I'm not clear about. Yeah, maybe that will work. Well, if anyone goes through this carefully and has a pretty concise explanation of how to pull the von Neumann equation out, I'd be happy to go through that. All right, so we have one last piece to cover, which is infinite dimensional Hilbert space. You guys ready for some mathematical technicalities? I'm sure some of you will love it, and others of you will be like, no, I don't want this, but here, we're going to do it. All right, did you have a question?
That we don't have a general insight into why that
postulate
works.
That I know of, yeah. Oh, okay, you're just confirming? Okay. Yes. Well, it shouldn't matter, right? Because it's a function of one variable, so they're equivalent. It's only a function of t. So that's a little piece that I never quite squared. So I don't know. A little bit of a... Okay, infinite dimensions. We're ending on a high note here. Okay, why are infinite dimensions so subtle? Well, there's many reasons. The first of which is that let's consider the position operator Q, the position operator and P minus IH bar. Let's do it in one dimension, d by dx, the momentum operator. Okay, the problem is that these are self-adjoint operators, but they have continuous spectrum. And in particular, the eigenstates of the position and momentum operator, which are unbound operators, aren't elements of the Hilbert space. These are self-adjoint. These are self-adjoint operators, with continuous spectrum, And most importantly, their eigenstates are not elements of the Hilbert space. Okay, so how do we see that? Well, it's easy. Remember, when we defined the L2R, that's the space of square integrable functions. Okay, so the eigenstates of Q are the Dirac delta functions and similarly the eigenstates of momentum are the plane waves where does my h bar come from? Oh, it's from there. Good. Do I need a minus sign maybe? Let's just make sense. Okay, so minus IH bar, minus IH bar. We're going to bring down a IK, minus IK. I have one minus sign too many, so this is plus. All right, good. Okay, so, I don't want to mess around with Dirac delta functions, so let me just show you the eigenstates of momentum. Okay, so let's call phi sub k. Let's call phi k of x. Let's define that to be e to the I k x. Then we recall for a square integrable function, we require that integrating over all x phi k x squared should be finite, should come to a, the integral should be finite so we can normalize the functions. But here what we have is the integral over dx. This is, of course, from minus infinity to plus infinity of e to the ikx times e to the minus ikx, which is just 1. So this is not defined. What do I say? Equals infinity is not. Doesn't exist, okay? So that means that these functions, which are the eigenstates of the momentum operator, are not elements of our Hilbert space. But yet we use them anyways. So the question is, why is that justified and how do we justify it? Or, yeah, in that order, I guess. Okay, let me do... Here's our von Neumann equation, in case you need to take a quick note of it. Okay, so first I thought I should just give you, so in the notes I gave you, I didn't define self-adjoint operators on infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces properly. So that wasn't done properly. I actually made note of it. So here's the proper way to define. So first, how do we define? Let's define self-adjoint operators. When we have an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. Okay, so the definition is a little bit subtle. Okay, so we start assuming that we have some operator T, and we're going to assume it's densely defined on the Hilbert space. Okay, this means that the domain of T which I'll denote like this is dense in the Hilbert space. Basically, what that means is that there's always take any element of the Hilbert space and any epsilon around it, there will always be some element of the domain of T within epsilon of that point. Then we could define the adjoint of T which we'll denote as follows. Note that in the mathematics literature, which is where you usually find this kind of technical detail, the adjoint, they used to use an asterisk for the adjoint. Is defined by two conditions. One, we define the domain of the adjoint consists of all phi in the Hilbert space such that there exists an eta in the Hilbert space satisfying T psi inner product with phi is equal to psi inner product with eta for every psi in the domain of T. So we first define the domain of the adjoint operator in this way. And then the second condition is that T adjoint acting on phi is equal to eta, where eta is the unique vector satisfying T acting on psi in the dual space, inner product with phi is equal to psi inner product with eta for every psi in the domain of T. Okay, so now we've defined the adjoint of this linear operator. Notice that this is all much simpler if you have a finite dimensional Hilbert space, right? We don't need all this worry about the domain because for a finite dimensional Hilbert space, the domain of the linear operator is the entire space. But when you go to infinite dimensions, the domain isn't necessarily the whole Hilbert space. It's some subset of the Hilbert space. And as long as it's a dense subset, then we can define these things. So now we say T is called self-adjoint if T is equal to T dagger. And it's important to observe that this requires, this means that the domain of T has to be equal to the domain of T adjoint. So the point is that equals minus ih bar d by dx, and the operator q, which is the multiplication operator. These are self-adjoint operators acting on h equals L2R are self-adjoint. But just to show you how subtle this is, and this is something that comes up, I know, in quantum gravity, that if you define the momentum operator on the Hilbert space H equals L2AB. Okay, remember what this means. Here we have square integrable functions on the real line. And here we have square integrable functions on some finite interval of the real line. So AB is just some interval. So this is what happens, remember, in wave mechanics when you have an infinite square well potential. So the particle can't leave some region from some point A to some point B. So in that case, the Hilbert space is L2AB, because we only integrate from A to B, not from minus infinity to plus infinity. And in that case, the momentum operator P is not self-adjoint. Okay, so I'm going to move over here next. Right. So now, how do we deal with the fact that we have these self-adjoint operators that we want to use because they represent these important physical observables, and yet their eigenstates don't exist in the Hilbert space? So there are two solutions. There are two rigorous approaches to include calculate using the position and momentum operator. Yes?
Sorry, we can just back up like 10 seconds. You noted that the momentum operator is not self-adjoint on a finite interval.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in undergrad quantum mechanics, we all did a particle in a box where it's got these finite boundary conditions, and we can find momentum eigenstates in there, can't we? So, and momentum is an observable still. So I don't really know how to square that with what I already know. I mean, you mentioned.
Well, this is where we're going,
okay,
actually.
Cool.
Okay. Even though their eigenstates are not in L2R. So the first approach is due to Dirac. Now, it's my understanding, I haven't studied this carefully, but I think Dirac just assumed this was fine, and later on some mathematical physicists proved that it was okay. And this is the standard textbook approach. Well, it underlies the standard textbook approach, even though the details are omitted. This justifies. So the way you do this is you just say, okay, we need a space that's bigger than a Hilbert space to talk about quantum mechanics. So here what you do is you define what's called a Gelfand triplet. So you define a space omega, which is a subspace of the Hilbert space, and you define a space omega x called the extended space, which is a superset of the Hilbert space. So this is called the rigged Hilbert space approach. And here, rigged doesn't mean like a casino you don't want to go to. Rigged is supposed to mean like a sailboat that's ready to set sail, right? The rigging is up and we can go. So here, omega is a nuclear space. Omega is called a nuclear space. And it's a subset of H, as I already mentioned. It's all phi in H, such that these functions go to zero at infinity faster than any polynomial. So here we add some polynomial in X that's growing. As obviously as x goes out to plus or minus infinity, this is getting very big. But we demand that this be bounded for every m, 0, 1, 2, all the way up. So in other words, what that means is that the tails of phi, as you go out to infinity, have to go to 0 exponentially. So this is some subset of functions of H. And then we define the extended space omega x as all quantities vectors chi, or elements chi, such that the inner product of chi with phi, which is the usual inner product, here I'm not using Dirac notation because I don't know if it's valid in this setting. Probably not valid. For every phi in the nuclear space. So we define this restricted set of functions that go to zero very rapidly, and then we extend the Hilbert space to include a class of functions whose inner products with respect to the restricted set give something well behaved. And then we can talk about things like, then for example, then we can talk about Q, well, I shouldn't use Dirac notation, I guess, but I will, where here the point is then Q is then an element of this extended space. And so is P. I don't see why they'd be okay. I mean, I didn't show you the problem over here, but I think the problem with the Dirac delta function is that what happens if you take the square of a Dirac delta function? I don't know.
I think when they work in those extended spaces, sometimes they make sure to change the Dirac delta into a contour delta because the Dirac delta is not perfect.
You know, I've never asked myself that question. So I don't know how to prove that this is the case, but I'm just following some references.
Yeah.
The question was whether or not the Dirac delta function, how to see that the Dirac delta function is an element of this extended space.
Right. So the way that you defined it, maybe it's not because you're like sort of implicitly in your definition where you write that inner product, you're already assuming that your thing is like a function, right? You're integrating it. But if you just say, claim that omega has some induced norm on it, and so then, ideally you want it to say be like norm closed of the Banach space, and then you just take its dual, like that's some well-defined notion.
You're
just saying you're looking at like, essentially the space of functions you wrote there is like Schwarz class, and so its dual is like tempered distributions, and the delta is in there.
So it's in the dual. Well, okay, this is a little bit beyond what I'm familiar with. So maybe we should just leave that because I can't justify this. Yes.
Question. Does this, is the unboundedness dependent on our choice of representation of the operator? Because there, I have the operators in the coordinate representation, right? What if I, for example, chose chose the B representation.
Oh yeah, right. This is actually a good point because, right. I mean,
you know, I would probably have the B operator,
yeah,
self-adjoint, and the X operator and not self-adjoint on the interval of B's, like on the interval AB of momenta. Mm. My Hilbert space would be L2 of interval on not coordinates but momentum.
You know, I don't know if Q is supposed to be self-adjoint on AB or not. I've never checked that. But actually, this does tie in with this question about this case because, I mean, whether or not we think of P or Q as having a Dirac delta function, eigenstate depends in the sense what basis you're using, what representation you're using. So, I mean, you know, in the momentum representation, Q is a plane wave and P is a Dirac delta function. So there's some subtleties here that somehow we're missing.
I'm not sure I understand your definition of omega star.
It's omega chi, x. It's an x.
Omega x. Where is chi taken from? What is chi?
Yeah, chi.
If you want to define the set,
yes.
An object from somewhere satisfying some properties, right?
Yes, I see what you mean. Right. Which actually, do I address that?
Define age such that, if you define omega star, you have to say chi in something such that.
Mm-hmm.
Just take a set of x. Omega.
Yeah, x should be some element of some even larger space that has some properties.
Right.
I don't know the right way to do that. What class of generalized functions? Linear functionals on omega.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. So these are linear functionals on omega. So this framework is meant to justify the kinds of manipulations we do calculations in wave mechanics. so it justifies expressions of the form, you know, the inner product of Q and P is a plane wave, where we include this normalization. And also, we can have a spectral resolution. For example, the identity operator can be expressed as integral over dx xx from minus infinity to infinity. And similarly for P. I mean, often when you do computations, it's important to insert the resolution of identity. And when we're dealing with wave mechanics, this is the form we it takes. So notice how this is not a Hilbert space, because in a Hilbert space, the orthonormal basis is countable, so it's always a sum. But here we have a resolution of the identity acting on L2R of this form, which is a continuous integral. And the justification for this is to think of these dual vectors and so on as elements of this larger space. And it allows us just to use Dirac notation and just pretend like there isn't a problem, basically. Pretend like it's all justified.
You need a concept for that?
Yeah, I don't have that in my notes. I don't know why you expect it, but... Explain what? I'm sorry.
So this is not here. We do not have a countable basis.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we circumvent that problem? Because then that this means that this Hilbert space is not separable. And
well, the point is that, you know, this object, if we in terms of the Hilberts, I've, you know, defined everything in Hilbert spaces pretty carefully, and this doesn't fit in that framework. But yet we use it,
yeah.
Right? As a resolution of idea, you can just insert this anywhere you want, and you can do a calculation, and you get a meaningful answer. So what I'm saying is that you can use this, even though it doesn't fit within our Hilbert space structure, because implicitly, we're assuming that we're dealing with this larger construction.
And in that larger space, this is...
So in this larger framework, which I mean, I guess you're just really seeing a superficial discussion of it here. In this larger framework, an object like this is mathematically well-defined. And so you can use it to compute, but in the background, you're using this structure.
I'm just not able to see how this is mathematically well-defined in that larger space, because that's still a Hilbert space.
It's not a Hilbert space, right? Here the triplet is the Hilbert space. Where is it? Yeah, here's our Hilbert space. But now we're defining this space, which is a superset of the Hilbert space.
So it does not have all the constraints that we
place. Right. So the point is, if we say that the background mathematical structure we're using to do wave mechanics is not Hilbert space, but instead is this triplet, where we're allowing some linear functionals to belong to a space that's not it's not the dual space to the Hilbert space, but some larger set. Well, no, it's a subset of the Hilbert space, so it has all the constraints of the Hilbert space. This is just a subset of the Hilbert space functions.
I'm just saying that because if omega x is a dual to omega, which is a subspace of the Hilbert space, so in principle it should have all the
constraints. I don't know if it's dual to that space. That's a good. Let me think about that. The question was, and this is good. So if we define omega x as a space of linear functionals on x, on omega, the nuclear space, then why isn't it a Hilbert space? So maybe. Oh, I see. So if it's a subset of the Hilbert space, it's not necessarily a Hilbert space because it might not have certain.
It won't be
complete. Right. Right. That's right. Okay, good. I think that's right. Sounds right. Okay, well, you know, so I guess this is something where you're just getting a kind of a peek into the issues that arise and trying to justify wave mechanics. But you can see why usual textbooks don't really get into it. Because there's an awful lot of mathematical background that goes into defining these structures. And you know, I mean, I think that you know the reason why I don't know all these answers is because this isn't something that's ever really come up in as a practical question for me. So just kind of nice to understand that this is where you'd have to go if you needed to look at some issue rigorously in the wave mechanics setting.
So now that you've justified it, or someone's justified it, can we always be using that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the point is that you can use these quantities in your calculations, and just implicitly, these objects are defined in some more general setting than Hilbert space. No, that's the assumption. And I mean, I don't know what the limits of this are, but I think for all practical purposes, it's not a problem. There's one other thing I wanted to tell you about, which I'll just really just touch on, which is we'd like to say that quantum mechanics lives in Hilbert space, right? That we need Hilbert space to do quantum mechanics, and that's sufficient. And here I'm telling you, well, it's not sufficient. So von Neumann found this unsatisfactory, and so he developed a machinery so that we could do wave mechanics rigorously within the Hilbert space picture. So all of this is actually unnecessary. Convenient but unnecessary, I guess. So I don't know how much detail I'm going to get into. This is in the notes, so you can look through the notes for examples. And this is also stuff that I've never really explored much beyond just kind of those few textbooks that do define it all carefully. Von Neumann's approach is to keep the Hilbert space formalism. Or framework, I should say. And he defined a generalized spectral decomposition. For self-adjoint operators. With continuous spectrum. Let me reword this as for any self-adjoint operator A with continuous spectrum. So the way he did this is to say that for any such A, there exists a one parameter family of commuting projectors or projection operators which we'll call E, and there's a subscript lambda, that's the one parameter, with lambda and R satisfying E lambda is greater, sorry, E lambda prime is greater than E lambda when lambda prime is greater than lambda. In the limit that epsilon goes to 0 from the right, E lambda plus epsilon is equal to E lambda. In the limit that lambda goes to minus infinity, the projector is 0. And in the limit that lambda goes to plus infinity, you have a resolution of the identity. You have the identity operator, I'm sorry. And this allows us to write A as an integral with respect to d lambda, sorry, as an integral of lambda dE lambda. So this is an operator valued quantity. And here we're integrating over real values for lambda. So this is where the terminology projection valued measure comes from. Because remember, the differential element in the integral is a measure in the sense of a Lebesgue integral. And here we're saying that the measure is operator valued. And in particular, it's a projection operator. So this is called a projector valued measure. Or for short, PVM. So now you know where the terminology comes from, we talk about in the finite dimensional case, we talked about doing a projective measurement. Which is just measuring in some orthogonal basis, and we called it a PVM. I think I might have used that terminology. That seemed a bit heavy-handed, like why the heavy-handed notation? Well, because we want to deal with the continuous spectrum case, we actually need to define a projector-valued measure to talk about measurements onto the position. Measurements of position and momentum are defined in this way with respect to some family of projection-valued projection operators. And so this would be, for example, decomposition of the position operator, and we would find the one parameter family associated with that, which example is given in the notes. And then you can talk about the probability of finding the particle in some interval AB, in the sense of the Born rule, is just the integral from A to B of dE lambda. So I've never found it necessary to really work with this structure. So I give you some examples in the notes, which you can look at if you're interested. But there's some subtleties to do with kind of defining, working out how to evaluate these quantities, which I'll just leave for self-study. Are there any questions about this? Yeah. Okay, so basically, the example I give in the notes you have is exactly that. You define you have a position operator, say Q, acting on some wave function, and it's a multiplicative operator. And then you define the spectral family as Q of A. So here A is playing the role of lambda. So here, this is basically the example from the notes. You define it as this theta function, A minus X, acting on psi of X, which is the usual Heaviside function. And then we can write Q operating on psi of X as an integral over A dQ of A times psi of X. And then we define this via Stieltjes integral as the limit as n goes to infinity of the sum over k equals 1 to n ak q ak minus q ak minus 1 psi of x. And then this evaluates to x psi of x. And this way you can interpret what I mean when I say the position operator is acting on psi. I really mean that I've identified this PVM quantity, Q of A, defined in terms of the Heaviside function, and the way I perform, this is integral over R. And I evaluate its action in terms of a Stieltjes integral. So the advantage, there's two advantages to von Neumann's approach. One is that you don't have to invent this funny business of the extended space, and you don't need to think about quantum mechanics as requiring a greater mathematical structure than Hilbert space. You just have to define more carefully what you mean by the self-adjoint operators and how to think of them, their action on the Hilbert space. The other advantage to von Neumann's approach is that one thing we didn't cover was continuous outcome measurements. And when we talk about continuous outcome measurements and continuous outcome POVMs, projection operator valued measurements, it builds on this mathematical structure implicitly, although usually it's suppressed. People don't worry about this, basically. So again, this is the kind of thing that if you're just doing quantum mechanics, you don't necessarily need to worry about it. It's just this underlying justification. But if you're looking at, you know, a broader framework like quantum gravity or something like that, then you have to worry about these kinds of details, like how do we deal with self-adjoint operators and so on. Self-adjoint operators with continuous spectrum. Okay, I think I'll just stop there. So let me just say thanks to everyone. I really enjoyed this class. Thought you guys asked great questions. Definitely have a few things I'm gonna have to look into now in the coming month to make sure I understand some nuances that you brought up. And thanks for, I think, being so attentive, and I don't know, I guess that's it really. My collection of t-shirts.